Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Buddham dhammam sangham namassam.
I was thinking maybe I'd, for a few reasons, talk a little bit about something that
I don't usually talk about when I give a reflection, because at least up until the past, maybe couple of years, it hasn't been as strong a inclination in my mind, or I guess a reflection or attitude as part of my practice, but has become more so in just little ways. That's around the subject of faith. Inspiration. One of the reasons I thought about talking a little bit about tonight is just because I'm going to have to drum up some faith to see if the words actually will come out. It's been a busy day. And so this talk is going on faith a bit here. I think the day has been very full with, I don't know how many different personas I've kind of adopted for various different things through the day. You know, there's been the healthcare worker persona and the insurance claims adjuster persona and the septic inspector persona. and now here's the monk persona. There's probably been a few others. And getting ready to leave for England and the meetings there. Tomorrow I'll be heading out, just trying to get stuff together. There hasn't been a lot of spaciousness to operate in today. So we'll see how things come out here. The topic of faith also kind of occurred to me because we've got Visakha Puja coming up in a couple of days. And it's one of the days of the year, one of the three kind of holy days or days for bringing special attention to some of the remembrances of the Buddha's dispensation, Visakha Puja being the celebration of the Buddha's birth, his enlightenment, and his passing away. The full moon of May symbolizing those three aspects, the legend having that on the full moon of May was his birth, was also his enlightenment, and then also his passing away all on that same day of various years. And there's a lot of inspiration that one can find from considering, reflecting, listening to the stories around this particular day and those particular events. We were talking a little bit about tea time, at tea time also as well, about desire, interest, inspiration. And somebody brought up the question of, you know, how the path is one of letting go and of being cool, cooling the desires of the mind. But how did that also apply to the desire for spiritual development, the interest in the path, the desire for learning more and, you know, really walking the path? And you know, we talked about how that was actually a very healthy form of desire, that kind of inspiration, interest that comes from practicing and considering the practice. So that's a very healthy healthy form of desire, chanda. So it's, I find that over the years, you know, my inroad interest started and still is maintained very strongly, perhaps primarily by the inspiring teachers that, the inspiring teachings that lead one to reflections on discernment, wisdom, considering the three characteristics in each of dukkha natta, developing them, penetrating them, trying to apply them and understand them deeply in one's own experience, and still actually get quite a bit of inspiration from that in itself. That is a basis for keeping me going in a lot of ways when I can turn to reflect on those. more recently, it's just also I've seemed to have a growing appreciation for some of the teachings that are more impactful on an emotional level. And I think that it's a very important part of the practice. The more I go along and the more I practice, and you know, maybe little bit by little bit, I understand some of the quote-unquote wisdom teachings a little bit, you know, more, and as the reflections are repeated and applied in different ways. But also with that, there seems to be a developing appreciation for how important it is to attend to the affective side of the mind. You know, a lot of times we think of the mind more in its intellect, intellectual capacities, the ability to pull together various themes of Dhamma, interconnect them, relate them, and hopefully also apply them. But as my understanding grows a little bit, I also feel that it's important to really consider the importance of just attending to that emotional side of the mind, the affective side of the mind, and to move into it, develop it, allow it, see how it really works. When you look at many of the aspects of the teachings, it kind of can come across in an analytical way, but they're often pointing to really deep energetic aspects of our being that need to be attended to. When you think of, say, the five hindrances, when you really consider them, they're really energetic states of the mind. You know, say the first one of ill will, when you really consider that, it's you know, it's easy to kind of get lost in it as, you know, the argument that I had with somebody, or, you know, the interactions that I have, how it manifests in those kinds of ways. But really what it's referring to is a deeply affective energetic state that is existent there and is part of the conditioning of the mind that then seeks out its object. Oftentimes these hindrances are dwelling kind of in dormancy, but they're there, and as soon as an object comes along, they jump out and attach themselves to that object and proliferate with it. So these are all, you know, whether it's the ill will or the sensual desire or sloth and torpor, restlessness, doubt, these are energetic affective states. And we, of course, can understand them on a certain level and apply them to situations in our particular life and how they manifest. But to really understand them and experience them deeply, one has to go deep into the energy and emotional side of it. And I think this is where the real letting go happens, when one is able to touch those in a real way and work with them, understand them, penetrate them. And that takes a certain amount of faith to let go of the intellect, the rational process, and to move into more of the experiential state of examination, exploration. So when I think of the Visakha Puja, primarily, I mean, there's all the stories of the birth, the legends around the birth, and passing away as well. And I think the one that moves me the most in an emotional sense, inspirational sense, is of course, the night of his enlightenment, the night of the Buddha's enlightenment. And sometimes when I hear and reflect on the stories around that, I just get goosebumps, because it's moving in a very deep way, not just in sort of the teachings, the Dhamma kind of a way, although of course that's integrated very strongly into it, but just the enormity of that particular night, the immense significance that it has for us, and how it was the culmination, of course, of, you know, many, many lifetimes of striving, and particularly in that current lifetime of Siddhartha Gautama. The enormity of the conviction and faith that the Buddha himself had to draw on to make that push on that night. You know, and some of the stories are dramatic, and some of them are more prosaic. But there's the all of the stories essentially of the forces of Mara that came to try and distract him and obstruct his progress on that evening. The legends around that, and whether you take them literally or symbolically, maybe isn't so important. But just to realize the enormity of the obstacles as they were presenting themselves as the Buddha was striving that night, and how being on the verge of his awakening, the forces came even stronger and more potent, and the amount of energy and strength and determination that he had to pull forth to just say, no, I don't believe this. This is Mara. This is manifestation of greed, hatred, and delusion. This is not the truth. It's difficult. It's hard to see past. It's convincing. But I know better than this. I've seen enough. I don't believe it. And when I think about that, I think, gosh, some of the things that I react to are so minor in comparison, and boy, I just really need to work on not being overwhelmed by those. And if the Buddha, can resist and not believe the strength and the power of those full-on forces in their entirety, then maybe I have the capacity to do that in my own small ways too. And then, they talk about the three watches of the night on the night of his enlightenment, and they're kinds of stories that perhaps we have to take on a bit of faith, because they're not experiences that most of us have access to that serve as stepping stones to the culmination of complete understanding. And so, as I think most people know, there were the three watches of the night, where the first watch of the night was the Buddha using his extremely highly developed mental abilities to see his innumerable past lives. It's actually the teachings around this are pretty minimal. There's not a lot of huge description other than that in that first watch of that night, presumably the first 4 hours or so of that evening, of that 12-hour period, he was able to review uncountable numbers of past lives and see his station, his clan, his livelihood, all the many different aspects of multiple uncountable past lives over eons of existence, as far back as he was able to get on that one particular occasion. And just to see all the various forms that consciousness took that was based on his own forces of greed, hatred, and delusion that propelled him from one life to another life, and how that manifested in physical reality. And then combined with the second watch of the night, again, we have to take this on faith, most of us, because we don't have the abilities to do this ourselves, but to examine not only his multiple lifetimes, but to see the arising and passing of many, many, other beings according to their own karma. So he was able to see the immensity of the joys and the sorrows, and particularly the dukkha of beings being born over and over and over again, going through the cycles of birth, aging, death, passing away, the difficulties that people experience, the karma that they created, for better or for worse, but always unending, no visible end in sight, and how samsara is essentially in itself is endless. There is, as he discovered, an escape from it, but the cycles of samsara, existence in samsara, is without beginning, without end. And that, the third watch of the night, of course, was the ending of the asavas, which, maybe reflect on a little bit more, but how those first two watches of the night, on the night of his enlightenment, served, at least in my mind, as best I can understand it, as the motivating force for him to make the final penetration to realize the truth, that the enormity of what he had experienced since beginningless time, and the enormity of the unsatisfactoriness, the suffering through the cosmos by being able to see beings being reborn over and over again according to karma, that level of motivation, of understanding, had to be present for him to be able to say, oh, this is incredible. I have to find the way out of this. I have to understand. I know that there is an answer to this, and I'm going to stay here until I penetrate this. Just because the enormity of what he had just seen was immense. And with that very strong, and maybe I hope this isn't an over-liberal use of the word emotional, but with that emotional impact propelled him, I think, to look so clearly and so deeply into the workings of his mind that he was able to see how the very, very deeply rooted underlying tendencies of passion, hatred, delusion were the forces that had kept him bound in samsara all this time, and was able to finally understand that at the deepest level, understand the cause of suffering, the fact of suffering, the cause of suffering, and analyzing the various factors of the path that he had pulled together to serve as the jumping off point for total unbinding, total release, and was able to end, stop the forces that kept him bound in samsara, and to just let them dissolve to the point where the gates to the deathless opened and he was able to walk through them. So to some extent, we have to develop our capacity to take on faith to a certain degree, this story, these teachings, because we, as I said, most of us don't have the capacity to create those levels of understanding for ourselves, at least at present. But we can use them, the stories, as a way to fuel our own motivation, to create a sense of faith and inspiration that the Buddha was able to do it, and that through the dispensation, we can too, and we can do it without actually having to go to the level of penetration of those past lives and seeing the karma of others directly. We can use those as inspiration to develop the other parts of the path to a sufficient degree that we can awaken. That is his teaching, that we don't have to quite go through the same thing that he went through to do that. He's given us a path and a teaching that allows us to, it's still a huge endeavor, but in essence he was able to distill his discoveries into a path that's accessible to more of us, even with some limitations of our capacities. We do have the sufficient abilities to apply the teachings and to realize the ending of suffering. And we have to, I find that the more I let that move me and motivate me, the more I can refresh my inspiration. There's times when we all have down cycles in our practice, minor ones, major ones, where things, conditions have come to fruition in some way that result in just a lot of obstruction, difficulty. And if we can tune in maybe to some of the more heart-opening kinds of reflections, and let them move us in ways that will help sustain us through some particularly difficult times, then those are practices to be undertaken and to be cultivated, and to allow ourselves to just be influenced by that, to be moved and inspired in any way that we can. One of the things that I find growing in terms of how it moves me isn't so much related to the particular night of his enlightenment, but of his first teaching, that when we chant the Dhammacakka Sutta, more and more now, if I allow myself to reflect on the sutta as we recite it in Pali or in English, I sometimes it gets to the point where I can be so moved to tears that I can't even finish the chant or progress through it. Just the areas where Kundanya has his realization that everything that arises passes away. One of the basic fundamental aspects of the teaching, that when fully penetrated and really fully understood on a very deep affective level, not just understanding it in the head, but that is the root base for entering the stream. Just hearing that being chanted or chanting it myself can bring goosebumps. And similarly, in that same sutta, when the Buddha realizes that Kundanya has understood, and he makes that utterance, Kundanya has understood, Kundanya has understood. And it's like, even though the Buddha is already fully enlightened at that point, he's moved. It's like, somebody in the world other than myself has penetrated at least partially to the understanding of this. And how he's just moved by that so much that his attempts at teaching have come to fruition for at least one person. And then, of course, all the devas, starting from the bottom and crying out in happiness and joy about the fact that the wheel of the Dhamma has started rolling. And how it goes from one heavenly realm up to the next, and all of them are so moved and inspired. The fact that the Dhamma has re-entered the world, that the true teaching has been re-established in the world, to the extent where the 10,000-fold universal system quaked and shook and trembled. And the radiance, far surpassing the radiance of the devas, appeared in the world systems. These things are, I find, more and more as time goes on, just move me to a state of tears. And the little and periodic times that I experience piti, it's usually from those kinds of reflections. And for me, bringing those to mind and allowing that to happen and encouraging that to happen opens the heart to really establishing a more sense of faith in the teaching. It starts to help move the experience into one of a real experience of conviction and happiness. Stories like the Buddha's around the Buddha's death can be really inspiring too, and just how the Buddha, even on his deathbed, in presumably a fair amount of pain, was able to just pull it together to be able to say to all the disciples around him, "Okay, this is it. Any last questions? Are you well established in your practice? Now's the time to speak. Now's the time to clear up any doubts. Now's the time to clear up any questions. I'm on my way out. Please take this one last opportunity, if you so desire." The amount of compassion he had for the people that he was leaving behind, to be able to do that. And his compassion towards Ananda, who he noticed was off standing in the threshold of a door somewhere, who was weeping. And he asks one of the other monks to go over and get Ananda, pull him in. And so they go and get Ananda and bring him back to the Buddha. And the Buddha says, why are you weeping, Ananda? And he says, well, you know, for so long I've served the Tathagata, and I don't even have, I can't even say that I've penetrated beyond the first stage of enlightenment. I haven't completed my work. And how ashamed I feel that with all the time and care and teaching that, you know, you've given to me, that I haven't been able to complete my work yet. That's why I'm weeping. And the Buddha responding, saying, Ananda, you know, for heaven's sake, you know, haven't I told you that, you know, you shouldn't lament at my passing? You know, how many times have I said that all compounded things are subject to decay? You know, you haven't been paying attention to my teaching. But then he says that in a very compassionate, very tender voice. And then goes on to further extol Ananda's virtues and how he has served so well to the Tathagata, and how that, you know, that attention he was able to give to Ananda right at the very last moments of his life, hopefully, you know, served as a reminder to Ananda to continue the teaching, to keep the resolve, which Ananda did. A bit of a time later on, Ananda was able to penetrate to complete enlightenment. So I just find that as well, those kinds of stories, you know, very emotionally inspiring to continue on, to not only consider the teachings and apply them in a reflective way, but to really see if there's ways to increase the depth of that penetration through opening the heart on a very deep affective level. So just a few reflections really to say that there's a deeper side to cultivate, that cultivating some of these reflections that help instill inspiration, chanda, give energy, reestablish faith, particularly in difficult times, and just to really encourage people to develop that side of the practice as well. So I'll leave that for tonight's reflection. Annyam dharmakataya sadhu karam jadamase. Sadhu.